From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And what a week. We heard from an unshackled Donald Trump, an emotional First Lady in response. And there have been almost daily WikiLeaks of emails, reportedly from Hillary Clinton's campaign manager.
National polls show Hillary Clinton widening her lead over Donald Trump after the release of that tape in which Trump said he used his star power to force himself on women. And for the first time this week, Democrats started to think they have a real shot at taking back control of the House of Representatives.
Here and Now,
2016.
And joining us today for our weekly political roundtable, Maria Elena Salinas, news anchor at Univision. Hi, Maria Elena.
Hi, how are you? Good
doing,
to talk to you.
Doing great. And Paul Steinhauser's with us as well, political director of NH1 in New Hampshire. Hi, Paul.
Jeremy, Robin, great to be with you.
So at a rally in West Palm Beach yesterday, Trump called his campaign an existential threat to a corrupt establishment. Let's listen.
The Clinton machine is at the center of this power structure. We've seen this firsthand in the WikiLeaks documents in which Hillary Clinton meets in secret with international banks to plot the destruction of U.S. sovereignty in order to enrich these...
Maria Elena, it seems like a different tone from Trump in the last week. What do you make of what he's been saying?
Well, let's remember that yesterday's speech was teleprompter Trump. It was not him just saying whatever he wants to say. So that sounds definitely like a strategy. And you know, I really believe now that what the Wall Street Journal said is probably true. He understands that he has his base and it's very difficult for him to try to gain more voters when it comes to maybe those who are not supporting Hillary or the independents. So he needs to attack Hillary relentlessly to dissuade Democrats from coming out to vote because he doesn't have the support, the logistical support that he was counting on from the Republican Party. So, yes, I think that he has become much, much stronger. And I think we can expect those types of speeches from here. It's 25 days now.
24 and a half,
counting,
I think.
24. Thank you so much.
Well, is it registering, though?
Thank you so much. It's less than what I expected.
But is it registering?
I think everyone's looking forward to November 9th.
Right. 8th. And the day after. Paul Steinhauser, yeah, is it registering, you know, this accusation that she gave speeches to these banks? I mean, that's what he's going at there. Is that registering?
It's registering among his base here in New Hampshire and in the other battleground states, of course. And that's what's interesting here, Jeremy and Robin. This is turning into a base election. And part of the reason is the third-party candidates as well. Gary Johnson is taking a lot of votes away from Hillary Clinton. So if this turns into a base election, Donald Trump's only mission between now and November 8th is to energize that base and make sure they all get out there. That's why you're seeing the increased rhetoric. He's also a little bit wounded, obviously, with all these controversies in the last 7 days now. And that's another reason you're seeing Donald Trump on the warpath. We're going to get a taste of that again tomorrow. Donald Trump's right back here in New Hampshire, his sixth visit since the Republican convention back in July.
When you talk about energizing the base, let's take a listen to Michelle Obama. Now, let's set this up. And people, after her speech last night in New Hampshire, in which she says she threw away her script and felt she had to go after Donald Trump for his comments this week, you know, some were saying, calling this historic, a defining moment. Others are saying, no, this was, you know, political. This is predictable. She's a partisan. Let's listen to a little of Michelle Obama talking about Donald Trump and his claims of groping women.
And I can't believe that I'm saying that a candidate for president of the United States has bragged about sexually assaulting women. And I have to tell you that I can't stop thinking about this.
Maria Elena, it went on for 40 minutes. What impact?
Well, we know that Michelle Obama is very popular. She's more popular than her husband. She's more popular definitely than both candidates. She's probably one of the most popular first ladies in history. So what she has to say definitely has an impact on Democrats. But there's very little that is going to dissuade his supporters. You know, I think one of the most shocking things that I've seen throughout this whole election, and there's been plenty of shocking moments, is to see a picture yesterday of a T-shirt with a woman wearing a T-shirt that said, Trump, you can grab me by the, with an arrow pointing down.
Yep.
In other words, people really don't care. I think when he said, I can shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and they'll still support me, now we are convinced that that is true.
You know, I saw a couple of people point out today that Trump may be, to for lack of a better phrase, shooting himself in the foot by going after the women who have accused accused him of sexual assault, sexual harassment, because that's exactly what he's saying that Hillary Clinton did to the women that accused Bill Clinton. Mm. Paul?
No, you're right. It kind of defeats his own argument. And it also hurts him with female voters, especially single female voters. He's down two new polls out here in New Hampshire in the last 12 hours. He's down 3 points and 6 points in the two polls. But among women, he's down around 20 points. This is not going to help him try to close that gap at all.
No, and you couldn't write this script, Jeremy. We've talked about this because you also, of course, have Bill Clinton, who had his own several episodes, but one, you know, the very public political one when he was president with women. And a week ago, a protester yelled at Bill Clinton during a rally. He said something like, "And one thing we know for sure," and the protester yelled out, "You're a rapist." I mean, it was quite stunning. In Florida earlier this week, Clinton was heckled by protesters chanting, "Bill Clinton is a rapist," as she campaigned with Al Gore. They were talking about climate change. Let's listen to a little.
"At this rate, my friends, my friends, please, let's focus on what's really important in this election and in your future and the future of our country."
I mean, you could not script this, Paul.
You know, it's funny you bring this up because last Friday I was covering Bernie Sanders. The senator from Vermont was here in New Hampshire campaigning for Hillary Clinton. I was covering at a rally in Nashua, and I was doing a live shot, and guess what happened? A protester came up right behind me and yelled out as loud as he could three times, "Bill Clinton is a rapist." So we're seeing this over and over again among Trump's, most likely Trump supporters.
What about the Clinton emails? Maria, Elena, let me go to you, because there have been a number that have kind of been dripping out, some about things that really are a problem for her. She's telling Wall Street bankers that politicians need a public and private position on issues in a speech to them. Some of them kind of more mundane, but has anything come out? And, of course, there was the one about Catholicism and one of her campaign staffers kind of making some knocks on Catholicism. But do you think that these are damaging to her?
You know, I'm not sure. I think they are damaging somewhat. But just like Trump, she has her base. And it might hurt her more with Bernie Sanders supporters, which is she's trying to attract. But really, it's no different from other campaigns and what other campaigns say in their interaction and in their internal strategy communications. It'd be very interesting if we ever had access to the emails going back and forth in the Trump campaign. That might be something very interesting to see. But I think one thing it does do is that it kind of makes the email situation worse, because now it makes people wonder, what could possibly be in those 30,000 emails that are missing? So, you know, just the fact that there are emails and that they're discovering communications there, whatever it is, some people might take it seriously. Other people might just think, you know, this is just what happens behind the scenes in campaigns. But it certainly doesn't help her with the email situation and those people who think that she was trying to hide something, and that's why they were destroyed.
Well, Maria Elena Salinas and Paul Steinhauser, you both seem to be saying the same thing, that there are intractable bases on each side. So what is it going to take for this independent that we hear about, this undecided, like the guy, Mr. Bone, in the red sweater, you know, that became so popular? What is it going to take?
You know, what's interesting is we just saw an article we were reading this morning that said that there's been an increase, like over a 2,000% increase in searches for write-in voters. And some of the names that people are looking at is Bernie Sanders and Mike Pence. So it's interesting. I think people are not happy with these two candidates, and they're looking for ways to vote for someone else and vote their conscience and vote their morals, even though I think they don't really understand that voting for a third-party candidate is actually going to help probably maybe Trump or Hillary.
I thought you were going to say there's been an increase in searches for Ken Bone, because we know that there has been for that. But Paul go ahead.
Yeah, he's got a lot of Twitter followers right now.
He certainly does. I just want to, in the minute we have left, go back to something we were talking about a little bit earlier, because I was asked a question this morning. Is Michelle Obama trying to set herself up to run for something in the future the way that Hillary Clinton did at the end of Bill Clinton's second term? What do you think, Paul? Do you think that that's what's going on here, or is this just about she really wants Hillary to win?
I think it's the latter right now. Listen, she's been very, very clear in the last year or two that she has no desire to run for the U.S. Senate seat that was going to be coming up in Illinois. I think it's a very different, you know, path for her than it was for Hillary Clinton coming out of the White House. But that said, you know, there was no Sherman-esque statement here. So who knows what's going to happen in 2020 or beyond?
Could it also
I've interviewed her three times, and the three times I've asked her the same question, and the three times she said, oh, no, definitely not.
Well, I was going to say, Marie-Lane, we only have a few seconds. Could it just be that she is a mother and a woman who got up and felt she had to say something?
Yes, she has a lot to say, and she's taken advantage of that incredible power that she has to try to make a difference in this campaign.
Marie-Lane Salinas, a news anchor at Univision, Paul Steinhauser, political director of NH1 in New Hampshire. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we've got another debate, the last one, coming up next Wednesday, if you can believe it.
A Prairie Home Companion will be on this weekend, but without its beloved creator, this guy.
Well, it's been a quiet week in Lake Wobegon, Minnesota, my hometown. Out on the edge of the prairie, got a little bit warmer here this last week.
Garrison Keillor with news from Lake Wobegon, the village that lived in his imagination and now lives in our memory. Garrison announced his retirement from the show last year in the same even-handed way most people muse about catching a bus. We spoke backstage at his last Tanglewood show.
I really don't look back. I have left a number of things in my life. I tend not to have much regret at all. Maybe I should. I'll work on it.
And that chuckle there, that's Chris Thiele, who's waiting in the wings to talk to us and to host Prairie Home Companion. Chris is the mandolin virtuoso turned radio show host. Chris, is that a surprise to you? Garrison was so nonchalant about leaving the show.
No, it's not. I've never seen Garrison worried about anything, come to think of it, over all these years that I've known him. And it doesn't surprise me to hear him say that he doesn't have regrets. And I don't think he should.
Well, we don't either. Chris Thiele, first of all, can we say welcome? I mean, you've been on our program before, but welcome to public radio.
Thank you so much. We're colleagues now, Robin.
Oh my, I mean,
we're colleagues.
I've gone to heaven now that you say that. Let's just remind people, 35-year-old, 4-time Grammy Award winner, 2012 MacArthur Genius Award recipient of the band Nickel Creek and the Punch Brothers. You appeared on the show at 15, you know, sort of a child prodigy. And now, you know, you're taking it over. As the New York Times said, it's kind of like Jimmy Fallon replacing Jay Leno, only not at all like that.
Right.
How are you feeling? Are you nervous?
There's always, for me, I love putting on shows. I absolutely adore it. It's why I've been doing it now for so long. But there are always, part of what I love about it are those butterflies that I get whether I'm hosting this show or you know, about to try out something new at a coffee house for 20 people. They're always there. And if they ever leave, I'll probably look into doing something else where I can find them again.
Well, but I mean, what about the, you know, the big change? I mean, Garrison Keillor, he is Hamlet. He's a thunderstorm. You are a sunrise. You are Jiminy Cricket. He's a bass. You're a tenor. I mean, tell us how you're approaching the show. What's it going to be like?
Well, it has to be different. It will necessarily be different because I'm a very different person from Garrison. I think me doing – no one wants to hear me doing my best Garrison Keillor.
Actually. You have one?
Well, Chris, I'm not sure if you should be doing that.
He's inimitable. He's one in a billion. He created this incredible show the actual format of the show, there's no call to change that. There's no reason to change that. It's like, I liken it to a string quartet, you know, two violins, viola and cello. What a profound music making machine the string quartet is. And what a profound way to organize 2 hours of variety is Prairie Home Companion. I look at it that way, and so if you'll follow the analogy, then Garrison is kind of like Haydn in that situation,
yes.
kind of having developed the string quartet, and I want to write for that string quartet. I can't wait to get my grubby mitts on that string quartet and do some creating and curating within its framework.
Yeah, but one of the strings was Fred's sound effects, and then there were the skits, and then I know you're going to retain the same band leader.
Yes, indeed, Rich Dworsky.
But are you going to write skits? Are you, how's that going to go?
I have actually written some skits, but I don't plan on doing it on a regular basis. Again, I think it's important that I stay in my wheelhouse. Garrison did what he was best at, and I certainly need to follow that example.
Except we have to remember. We have to remember too that Prairie Home Companion started. As a, because he was inspired by the Grand Ole Opry and the idea of a music variety show, it evolved into the other things. And so,
right. The one, yeah. I remember him telling, when we sat down, one of the first times we actually sat down in person to talk about this, in fact, the very first time we sat down in person to talk about this, I asked him about that. I kind of was almost like a reporter asking him, why did you do this? Why did it start? And it was he loved the Grand Ole Opry, but felt like it could use a little bit more. He loved it when Minnie Pearl would talk to people, and felt like there could be a little bit more of that. And I completely agree. As someone who's appeared on the show almost exclusively to deliver music, I've always loved delivering that music in the context of the conversation and the skits, and so we're retaining that. The rough proportions of this show won't change at all.
Yeah. Well, it's just so hard again to imagine it, and exciting to imagine it, but we don't have to imagine far because you've been hosting the show before. Let's listen to a little bit of a recent appearance. We're going to set it up a bit. You're in the middle of a skit where you've been meeting people who basically make fun of your tiny mandolin. And then you tell a story about being blessed with the ability to play it.
And suddenly, I was able to play the instrument. I could play anything. Beethoven. I mean, Black Sabbath. Strauss. Zeppelin. I could play anything, but nobody wanted to hear it.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much.
A little bit of the skit there. Now, you can play anything. Are you going to be playing everything? I mean, what kind of guests are you going to play with?
Well, the premiere is coming right up. That's going to be Jack White, a hero of mine, and Lake Street Dive is going to be on.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it will. I think the sonic palette of the show will expand a little bit, hopefully to include the width and breadth of the good things going on in the world. And it will continue, of course, to be a home for, organically made roots music. But I do think it's important to be a soundboard for all of the lovely things that are happening.
We understand that you want to write a new song every week. I know you have your mandolin there. Which we're thrilled about. Can we have a little taste of a song that you
yes,
are thinking?
You can.
Yes,
you can. Let me see here. If I can pull up this, let me pull up this lyric that I actually finished the lyric for this week's song of the week.
All right.
Moments ago. So I will try the first verse of it on you. Season of orange and yellow. Mm-hmm. I don't mean the hue of a particular fellow. Mm-hmm. I'm talking foliage and pumpkins, a candy corn, chipping munchkins, remember, and it goes on and on.
I was going to ask if you were going to go into politics at all.
Lightly, gently. This one is meant to be sort of to provide some respite.
And how about the sing-alongs that Garrison was known for? With the, you know, the, I mean, are you going to do Abide with Me? I mean, you know, some of the old spirituals and those great sing-alongs.
I love one of the ones that he did recently. I think it might have been one of the last shows that I was on with him. He launched into the of all the money that e'er I had, I spent it in good company, and all the harm that e'er I've done, alas, was done to none but me. I love that song so much. Good night and joy be with you all. Things like that, obviously, will continue to have a home on the show, and the power of people singing together is undeniable, and can't be overestimated.
I hope that would be your answer. Chris Thiele, new host of Prairie Home Companion. We're going to leave you with one of those guest appearances you had. It was at Tanglewood in Western Massachusetts. People roared after you played. Chris Thiele, best of luck to you.
Thank you so much, Robin.
And just, you've been backstage. You know that nobody, it's not even finished. It's not even ready when you get on stage, right?
Oh, No. You. The plan is never finished. It's only abandoned.
Gotta rub it in the log, and I ain't got my dog, and how will it get him? I know. Gonna get me a brown, I'll twist it in his hair, and that's where I'll get him. I know.
It's been 4 days since Hurricane Matthew dissipated, but more flooding is expected in North Carolina as all that rain that came through the central part of the state makes its way downstream to coastal communities. Will Michaels, reporter from North Carolina Public Radio WUNC, is in Chapel Hill. And Will, earlier this week you told us one of the biggest concerns was these hog waste lagoons that, if flooded, would join the flood water, and that's happened.
That's right, Robin. The floodwaters have made their way over the Hog Lagoon waste pit walls. The state environment secretary says the walls themselves have not actually been breached, but yes, the water from the flooding and those hog waste lagoons have been mixing together. It's very obvious to see because there's this pink film that covers the top of the hog waste lagoons from the bacteria that grows on all of that waste.
Oh, that's really, really tough. So obviously the concerns are about health issues.
Right. It's a health issue for people downstream. And again, what we've been seeing all through the entire week is all of this rain that moved, as you said, from central to eastern North Carolina, making its way down the major rivers. The Neuse River is expected to crest in Kinston today. It crested in Goldsboro. That's some good news for inland residents, is that the waters are finally starting to recede inland. The bad news is, again, all of that water is making its way toward coastal communities, which have not seen the worst of the flooding. You know, the death toll is now up to 22 people because some people are trying to get back to their homes and going around the barriers that have been set up and venturing back into the floodwaters. The governor says stay out of the water for at least a few more days.
Well, we're understanding that it might be months for some people.
That's right. There are almost 4,000 people that have been moved to shelters across the state. The governor says it could be a year before some of them get their homes back. As the floodwaters make their way to the east, we see some of these small towns being totally inundated. Princeville is actually a good example. Princeville is right next to Tarboro on the Tar River. It is actually one of the country's oldest towns chartered by African Americans. It is completely underwater. The same thing happened to the town in 1999 from Hurricane Floyd. There was a levee that was built after Hurricane Floyd, but it did not actually keep the Tar River from flooding the entire town. We have every reason to believe that FEMA is going to have to give the same sort of support to that town that they did in 1999. They gave $26 million to the residents of Princeville in 1999. We have every reason to believe they'll have to do that again.
Well, just quickly, any water advisories? Can people drink tap water? What are other issues?
FEMA is bringing in bottled water for residents of eastern North Carolina until cleanup crews can move in. That's the problem here, is that until the floodwaters actually recede, they can't get in to fix these environmental problems. We're seeing in places like Fayetteville, where the water has started to recede, that when it does, the roads are completely gone in some areas. They've been washed out, and so people can't actually make their way back to their homes or to school. I talked to the superintendent of Cumberland County Schools, actually, in Fayetteville. He still has the ambitious goal of opening up schools on Monday. He said that when kids are back in school, you can start to normalize things. Yeah. And so he's trying to get schools back open. But again, he's going to have to come up with new bus routes because the roads are just gone in some places.
Hmm. That's Will Michaels of North Carolina Public Radio WUNC on the still terrible situation in North Carolina from Hurricane Matthew. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Robin.
A survey out this week from the American Psychological Association finds more than half of U.S. adults feel very or somewhat stressed by the election. If you're one of them, you might have what one therapist is calling election stress disorder. That therapist is Dr. Stephen Stosny, who joins us via Skype. Welcome.
I'm pleased to be here.
And I was talking to somebody the other day who said that they felt like there was a dark cloud over America right now, that people are on edge about this election, and it's really making them anxious.
It's certainly making my clients anxious. I do mostly couples counseling and been doing it for 30 years and have never seen anything quite like this.
Well, what are people saying to you?
Well, it's not so much that they're talking about the election. It's the way the couples interact with each other. They're not seeing each other as partners. They're seeing each other as opponents. They're not interested at all in reconciliation. They want to win. They're calling each other names a lot more. It looks like a debate.
You're talking about couples where one is on one side and one is on the other side?
No, that's the remarkable thing. That used to be the case in previous elections. In this election, if they're both on the same side, what's happening is that all the negative emotions that are being modeled for them are being downloaded into their relationship. Research shows that emotions are modeled, the way we regulate our emotions are modeled by authority figures, and that they're very contagious. If you're around a resentful person, you're going to get resentful. And that's what they're bringing into the conference room.
Well, explain that, because you're saying that just by watching the election news or just by watching what's going on the campaign trail, it's really having that big of an impact on their own relationship?
It is, not only in their relationship. If you're driving and a political announcement or some political quote comes on the radio, you look down at the speedometer, you're going about 15 miles per hour faster than you were. And if there's too much traffic for that, you're probably tailgating the car in front of you. That's because even low-grade anger activates every muscle group of the body, and it doesn't take very much for that foot muscle to get activated. You won't concentrate as well at work, and you're not going to be as sweet to your kids as you would normally be, because these negative emotions were important to our survival, and they get transmitted at a very high degree.
So if somebody's listening to this and they are one of these people, and maybe right now they're going 15 miles an hour above the speed that they should be going, what should they do?
Well, they should think of the kind of, if they're driving, the kind of driver they want to be, the kind of person they want to be, the kind of parent they want to be. As soon as you start thinking about values rather than feelings, you go into the adult brain. That's the upper prefrontal cortex. That's the part of the brain that makes you who you really are. In the toddler brain, that's where you're in a political debate. Mine, no. It's self-obsessed. It can't see any other perspective but your own. As soon as you start to appreciate the complexity of anything, you get into your adult brain, and that automatically regulates your emotions.
Hmm. So practical tips would be what?
Try to see the complexity of the situation. See, the toddler brain blames, denies, and avoids. If you go into a room and a toddler's broken his toy, you ask him what happened to it, he'll say, blame it on someone, or say, I don't know, or try to hide. in the adult brain, as soon as something goes wrong, if you say, how can I make this a little bit better? The toddler brain can't make anything better. It's just an alarm system. That automatically shifts you into your adult brain, where you have billions more neurons firing for you.
Do you expect that after the election is over, all this anxiety will go away?
Well, it won't go away right away, because this is such a negative election. Nobody is really for a candidate. You're against someone. And whenever you're against someone, your brain needs adrenaline. It needs anger. So when the election is over, whichever candidate wins, whichever candidate you supported, you're going to immediately have buyer's remorse. why did I really support this one? Because you're not really for that person. You're against the other one. People will watch this election to see the concession speech of the loser, not the victory speech. And it takes a longer time for negative emotions to go away. But my hope is, and my expectation is, within a few, by Christmas time, the effect should be gone.
Dr. Stephen Stosny is author of Soar Above, How to Use the Most Profound Part of Your Brain Under Any Kind of Stress. Dr. Stosny, thank you.
Well, thank you.
This fall, a record number of so-called English language learners, or ELLs, are attending school in the U.S. That's about 5 million students. And in Philadelphia, where nearly 13,000 ELLs are enrolled in public schools, district officials are trying to meet the growing demand for more programs and better services. NPR's Claudio Sanchez reports.
In a cramped, windowless room on the first floor of Philadelphia's massive school district office building, 16-year-old Rosario Maribel Mendoza Lemus sits in a corner, nervously rubbing her sweaty palms on her jeans.
Okay, here we go. We're going to begin the test. Un examen, okay?
In front of her, a three-ring binder with the English test she'll have to take before she's assigned to a school. A counselor hovers, pointing to a drawing of a book.
Do you know what this is in English? No? How about this? En español?
Rosario arrived in Philadelphia this summer to join her mother and father. Her schooling back in Honduras was sporadic. She got no further than sixth grade, which means she'll have to attend the district's newcomer academy, which is really the only option for teenagers who don't speak a word of English. By mid-morning, this intake center has registered several more children. Parents seem anxious, though, because they know that most schools in Philadelphia do not offer the full array of programs and services that ELLs need. Southwark, in South Philadelphia, is an exception. Today, parents are picking up paperwork, mingling with teachers, and trying to see Andrew Lukoff, the principal.
We're getting to the point of being overcrowded, so we have a lot of families that want to come here because of the instruction and the services that we provide for our immigrant and refugee families.
Lukoff says nearly half of his 700 students this year speak a language other than English at home.
We've had some students here that were in refugee camps that did not have access to any kind of schooling and never have been taught how to read or write, and it's a challenge.
Southwark's ELL students come from China, Vietnam, Burma, Nepal, Cambodia, Indonesia, and Latin America. The absolute focus here is on reading. Shally Rutterman teaches English K through 8.
First of all, the students are grouped according to language proficiency. So if a child is 12 years old and is reading at a second grade reading level, then the teacher will instruct at that level so that the child can comprehend.
That doesn't mean a 12-year-old sits with second graders. Instead, she's pulled out of her sixth or seventh grade classroom for up to 2 hours of intense English instruction, vocabulary, grammar, pronunciation. Another option is known as sheltered instruction.
Last year, I had 9 different languages in my classroom.
Dina Palermo's job is to get ELLs to learn English as quickly as possible without having them fall behind in other subjects.
Instead of having the students being pulled out, taken out of the classroom, I provide all of the lessons to them, whether it's math, science, English, social studies.
Palermo says it wasn't always this way.
When I first started with the district, the ELLs were like lost children. The teachers really didn't have any idea of what to do with them. There was no real communications. Parents had no idea, and there wasn't that trust there.
Back in the late 1980s, the failure rate among non-English speakers was so high, Parents and local community activists sued to force the school district to come up with better programs. Lydia Lemus, a researcher with the school district, says by then the sink or swim approach had been largely discredited.
The sink or swim approach works for some people, but it's not supported by research. What the research shows is like the bilingual program shows better achievement for the students.
The key in teaching ELL, says Lemus, is simple. If you build on the child's native language rather than discourage it, the transition to English fluency is easier. Parents love it because it gives their children the option of keeping their first language. Principal Andrew Luca says this has helped Southwark build a lot of support for ELLs, who are no longer stigmatized or seen as deficient, but as students who can and do succeed. Claudio Sanchez, NPR News.
The Black Panther Party celebrates its 50th anniversary tomorrow. When the movement began in Oakland, California in the 1960s, leaders said it was to defend against police brutality and racial discrimination, to protect and support blacks with lunch programs and armed security patrols. But then FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover said it was the Panthers who were a threat to security. Well, today, young artists are reexamining the Panthers' legacy to create art aimed at inspiring a modern revolution. Chloe Veltman from Here and Now contributor KQED reports.
If you want to get a sense of how art goes hand in hand with political activism, spend a little time with Emery Douglas.
It's all the way up to the just to your right.
Terrific. His Oakland, California apartment is home to a modest collection of Black Panther memorabilia, including a slew of books about the party. Douglas created striking images for the Panthers' daily newspaper, like a famous ink drawing of an angry-looking pig dressed as a cop, armed to the snout with a baseball bat and canisters of tear gas and mace.
Symbolically representing the police themselves in relationship to their bad manners in the community.
Art was a powerful weapon in the Black Panthers' arsenal. It helped to shape people's views about the party. And as Panthers got arrested, art also brought in money to pay legal fees. Bands like the Grateful Dead and the Panthers' own rock group, The Lumpen, performed benefits for party members like Bobby Seale, who found themselves on the wrong side of the law.
Bobby must be set free, we're singing. Bobby must be set free,
just automatic.
There's a new generation of artists who've devoted themselves to tackling many of the same problems the Black Panther Party set out to solve. Oakland musician and activist J. Marie Hill is one of them. She didn't start out paying much attention to the Panthers.
I wasn't connected to the history of Black activism even as I grew up in the Bay Area.
But Hill's been struck by the near-constant barrage of news about African-Americans being killed by police piling up in her social media feed. She says she's been inspired by the Panthers' sense of urgency towards their mission. You can hear it in her song, We Comin'.
Something that the Panthers were absolute about, you know, was the idea that we're not going to wait for you for your approval. We're coming. We have these demands and we're not going to wait for you to tell us it's okay.
Hill and other artists are also using the Panthers' 50th anniversary as a way to refocus attention away from Panther men and onto Panther women.
The women in the BPP, the Black Panther Party, held it down, truth be told.
Yes.
You could not have done it without us.
We were right. That's a scene from Dimensions Dance Theatre's Project Panther. The group first performed the piece for the Panthers' 30th birthday in 1996. This time around, they've added a female character, played by Brittany Turner.
Then tell the whole story. We helped and played important roles with the students, the papers, breakfast programs, spreading awareness, right?
Yes, correct.
Another critique today's artists have of the culture surrounding the Black Panthers has to do with the glorification of its leaders.
Black is beautiful!
Party celebrities like Huey Newton, convicted of manslaughter charges in 1968, were frequent targets of the FBI, and the focus of much of the controversy surrounding the party, like allegations against some of its members for drug abuse and violence. Many artists I spoke with now want to highlight the important role ordinary people played in furthering the Panthers' mission. Take the new book of portraits by photojournalist Brian Shee and historian Yehuru Williams, The Black Panthers, An Unfinished Revolution. Here's Shee.
I would call it adding a dimension to the Panther history and the Panther story that really hasn't been told yet, and that's the viewpoint of the rank and file members.
Shee's photograph of former Panther Richard Brown speaks to this. Brown coordinated Black Panther jobs and education programs at a community center in San Francisco. In the photo, Brown, now 75 years old, looks cool in a leather jacket and a t-shirt bearing the slogan, "All Power to the People."
The effect of the portraits is to really humanize people that I think have been really demonized.
Brown stares at the camera knowingly, daring you to take up the revolutionary mantle. If you want to take up his dare, one place to start your schooling is the Oakland Museum of California. Its new exhibition, All Power to the People, The Black Panthers at 50, features a bronze replica by artist Sam Durant of an enormous wicker chair. It's the chair Huey Newton sat in when he posed for what has become perhaps the Panthers' most iconic image. But museum curator Rene de Guzman says there's a twist. It's interactive.
And the public's invited to sit in it, so physically they can sit within the legacy of the Black Panther Party and reflect upon those ideas.
Step up. Take a seat. Have a think. That's what these artists are hoping you'll do. For Here and Now, I'm Chloe Veltman in San Francisco.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.